move to the last case this morning. United States versus Wayne Lewis and Lewis versus Bolden. Dave?
Counsel, may it please the court, Greg Dice on behalf of Appellant Dwayne Lewis. This case involves a complaint that Dwayne Lewis filed in Indiana State Court against Susan Bolden, who is the branch manager of the Midwest America Federal Credit Union in Fort Wayne, Indiana. In this lawsuit, Mr. Lewis claims that Bolden violated his rights to financial privacy based on certain disclosures that she made to members of the Federal Bank Robbery Task Force who were investigating a robbery that had occurred at the credit union.
Mr. Dice, I have a question about the two points you've raised before us, because ultimately what happened after the 15-14 ruling is Ms. Bolden removes this case that you've just described to the federal court, and the federal court dismisses it on 12b-6 grounds.
Right.
So my concern is whether the 15-14 issue is a live issue at all. Why is this not moot at this point? He's lost in the merits. The case doesn't even exist anymore, and I can't see what remedy this court would be able to give him on 15-14 that would have any meaning.
Well, the injunction, the protective order that the district court entered was broad, and it does cover this particular lawsuit, but it's also broad enough to cover other potential lawsuits.
But he's raised, but he's issued and claim precluded, for that matter, against any lawsuit that arises out of this transaction. Anyway, anything that could rightly be seen as within the scope of 15-14, isn't he?
There would be an argument that he would be procedurally barred with respect to Ms. Bolden. However, there's other potential defendants, one primary being the Midwest America Federal Credit Union. So to the extent, Judge Wood, that your question is, does this really all boil down to the 12b-6 question, whether he stated a claim in the complaint under the Right to Financial Privacy Act, I would agree with you. I think the answer to that question is yes, and it disposes of both the 12b-6 question and the Section 15-14 question. But the protective order remains on the books, and while it does certainly prohibit this particular lawsuit, although it's sort of odd because the district court then subsequently adjudicated the merit, so I don't know if that constitutes...
Well, that actually leads to my next question. Will the record reflect whether... As I recall the timing, Bolden, once it's in federal court, files the 12b-6 motion on July 24th, and the court's ruling on that is about a month later, I think August 26th or thereabouts. Did Lewis file a response to that motion? Was he informed in sort of a Lewis against Faulkner sort of way that he was entitled to file? Of course, he was pro se at the time, if I recall.
That's right, Judge Wood, and he was. Judge Lee did make the proper Lewis v. Faulkner notification to him that he had an opportunity to respond, and he did file a response.
So he did file, okay.
Yes.
He did not, in other words, construe the protective order as forbidding him from speaking up at the 12b-6 stage once the case was in federal court.
No, and I think the briefs make this clear, but Judge Lee presided over both proceedings. So I think getting the notification from Judge Lee gave Mr. Lewis, made Mr. Lewis understand that he was able to respond, and he did in fact respond.
Okay, thank you.
Did Mr. Andrews' criminal trial shed any light on whether Ms. Bolden volunteered the identifying statements about Messrs. Andrews and Lewis, or whether she did so at the instigation of the investigating agent?
I don't think so, but I suspect that Ms. Nomei can probably speak to that question better than I could, not having participated in the criminal proceedings against Mr. Andrews. But I suspect that the answer is no, because I don't know that that would have been an issue there. I don't think that she was there, that the circumstances of her disclosure would have been an issue in the criminal proceeding. And in any event, that wouldn't have been information that was available to Judge Lee at the time he disposed of the 12b-6 motion and then the earlier protective order.
Given the evident ties between the two, you know, Lewis and Andrews, and the fact that the two of them filed their nearly identical complaint against Ms. Bolden immediately after Mr. Andrews obtained her name in discovery, why wasn't Judge Lee entitled to infer that the complaints were filed as a way to harass her? I mean, I know your argument's in the brief, and I'm
right.
No, I think asking you to go beyond that.
Right. Was there something that the judge could infer by the fact that they filed the lawsuits right after the Jenks material was disclosed, and that the complaints were identical? I think so, but does it go so far? Did it allow the district court's conclusion that Mr. Lewis, as opposed to Mr. Andrews, filed his lawsuit for the purpose of circumventing the federal rules of criminal procedure, i.e., assisting Mr. Andrews in the pending criminal prosecution against him? I don't think so. And did it also answer the question as to whether or not the lawsuit was filed for a legitimate purpose? To the extent that the theory of the government or that the district court's conclusion rested on the implicit assumption that they had some way conspired to both harass Ms. Bolden and then also to gain the benefit of the more liberal discovery rules in the state court, it seems to me that one lawsuit would have done just would have served that purpose as opposed to two. So I think that while Mr. Lewis may have been relying on Mr. Andrews in some way, as far as the arguments that he was making, and certainly I think it's clear that, that the way he found out about Ms. Bolden was through Mr. Andrews. Most certainly the district court was justified in making that logical conclusion. I think that's one of the problems here, separating the two, that although Mr. Andrews certainly had a motive to try and dissuade Ms. Bolden from testifying based on the pending criminal prosecution against him, the same cannot be said for Mr. Lewis.
Were they in the same cell? Do I remember reading that someplace?
They were in the same jail.
Jail.
I do not believe that they were in the same cell, although I'm not certain Judge Wood.
Should we put any importance at all on the fact that they both sought this exorbitant sum of $2 million from Ms. Bolden in their complaint?
I don't think the unfortunate reality is that everyone swings for the fences, I should say. And
the very same fence always?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think you just have to the extent that you're going to, that the court wants to look at the complaints, I think it's more than just the allegations of damages. I mean, it's the theory, it's almost paragraph by paragraph, an identical complaint. So I concede to the court that the complaint certainly allow some type of inference that they were, well, I don't think it's an inference. I think Mr. Lewis would make the concession that he came up with the Fourth Amendment theory and came up with his damage amount after talking with Todd Andrews. But I don't think that necessarily answers the question as to why he filed the lawsuit. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve the remainder.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. LeMay.
May it please the Court, Tina Nome for the United States of America. We instituted the suit under 1514 to protect Ms. Bolden because she was a potential witness and actually the victim in the armed bank robbery that had occurred.
Well, now, Mr. Lewis suggested the validity of the protective order entered against him is now a moot point now that Mr. Andrews has been convicted. Do you agree?
I don't agree for a couple of reasons. First of all, he raised it in his reply brief. He didn't raise it initially in his brief.
Now that Mr. Andrews has been tried and convicted, what reasonable possibility is there that the civil action would have the potential to intimidate Ms. Bolden?
Well, the purpose, you're right, was, Your Honor, to protect her, and we did that. And then the 12B6 was granted. So, in essence, you could say that the case is moot because it is now over and completed, and he can no longer sue Susan Bolden. The protective order was in place for a period of 3 years because at the time we did not know what was going to happen with the 12B6 suit, nor did we know if Mr. Lewis was going to file any more pro se pleadings against Ms. Bolden. But we set out to accomplish the protection of Ms. Bolden, and if you were to find that it is moot because she has in fact been protected and it precludes Mr. Lewis, then we are going to do what we can to protect Ms. Bolden. And that's exactly what 1514 was set out to do. Now, it is in effect for a period of 3 years. I don't know, you say moot. The issue, I don't know what the jurisdiction of the court is. I'm a criminal lawyer, not necessarily a civil lawyer, but since the case has already been decided and the order is issued, I don't know if the Court of Appeals can then just turn and say, well, we've had this issue and we've decided now it's moot, so we don't have to address it. And
well, look, we regularly, if somebody's complaining about a preliminary injunction and then events overtake a case and there's a permanent injunction entered, we don't bother to review whether there would be a preliminary injunction properly entered. It's absorbed, if you will, into the final result. And so that was my concern here. But since time is short, let me also throw out for you that if for some reason it weren't moot, I'm very concerned with the way the government proceeded, given the explicit language of 1514b2, which gives the right to a hearing, referred to in paragraph 1, and it says any adverse party named in the complaint shall have the right to present evidence and cross-examine witnesses, none of which happened here.
Oh, it did. We had a hearing. Judge Lee held a hearing.
You didn't have cross-examination of Ms. Bolden. You didn't have cross-examination of the agent who submitted an affidavit.
Your Honor, there was evidence that was presented. They had the opportunity to present evidence as well. The court had sufficient evidence in the record. Now, one of the other
arguments...
What happened
to cross-examination? Do you think Congress just threw that in for fun?
Well, if you look at the legislative history, Congress said that we would accept affidavits from the defense attorneys, and if you look at the Tyson case, they use an affidavit of the defense attorney, because we're not going to subject Ms. Bolden.
Why did Congress say cross-examine witnesses?
Well, they say that in one respect.
And does that mean that the district court is entitled to hold a procedure under which that's impossible?
But in this case, there were no disputes about the facts, and I think that's the most important thing. There were no disputes that Susan Bolden gave this information, and she volunteered that information, let there be no dispute.
The dispute is about whether she was being harassed by the filing of a lawsuit that, let's say, was a clumsy effort to raise a statutory claim. We don't require people to plead legal theory, so it doesn't really matter that he said Fourth Amendment.
But as we set out in our brief, I don't think it's fair to have to subject the victim to come in, because that's the very harm you're trying to protect. You're trying to keep Ms. Bolden from being cross-examined from Duane Lewis and Todd Andrews by the filing of this lawsuit, and in the legislative history they
say... I don't
say,
see where in 1514... I mean, the Congress could have written that into it. But I just don't see where that's there.
Well, Mr. Lewis didn't call Ms. Bolden. He has subpoena power. Mr. Andrews didn't call Ms. Bolden. They were content with the record as it stood. The judge asked them if they had any additional information and evidence. The information was in the record. They knew how to file objections because Duane Lewis had already filed an objection to the temporary restraining order. So there was an opportunity for all that. It's just that in this case, the facts were all agreed to, and the issue was, what is the conclusion to be drawn from those facts? And the district court found that the conclusion to be drawn was that it was harassment.
I mean, what about the Anti-Injunction Act?
It
does
is not
the federal district court have jurisdiction to enjoin an ongoing state court proceeding?
We're specifically exempt from the anti-injunction provision under 2283 because it is a suit brought by the United States or one of its executive branch agencies. So we're not subject to that provision. And there are cases in support of that, which are in the appendix.
Mm-hmm.
My time is up, unless there's other further questions.
You said something, and I may have just missed it.
All right.
But we can't tell from the complaint whether she volunteered the information or supplied it at the request of the government agents, can we?
I think you can from the appendix. Mr. Lewis, I attached a copy of Detective Vaughn's statement, which was, in fact, Ms. Bolden's statement. And in there, you get the recitation of facts. And I think if you look at all our briefs, you'll see what happened is she overheard the radio traffic about the car.
Right.
She then put two and two together and remembered, in light of everything that had just happened to her, that in fact there had been some sightings of this car and that the people had come in and conducted a transaction.
Yeah, but I'm talking about supplying Mr. Lewis's name, social security number.
So she on her own then, when she heard this, she connected the two, and then she went around the credit union to try to find a piece of paper where they had written the identities of the individuals, that being Mr. Lewis and Mr. Andrews, and their social security numbers, and a partial plate of the car. She then gave that to the law enforcement officers. So she voluntarily did that. She didn't do it at their insistence. And as we argued, it wasn't financial privacy records because it wasn't bank account information that we normally would get by way of subpoena. It was, in fact, just information about people who had come into the bank on any given day and conducted a transaction. But it was suspicious activity. And really, if Ms. Bolden hadn't put two and two together, we probably wouldn't have solved the crime, and Mr. Andrews wouldn't have been convicted, and we wouldn't have been able to get the smoking gun, which was him with the evidence. So she was very, and in light of the fact that she was subject to this victimization where she had a gun held to her and a masked man robbed her and she had to open the vault, she's smart enough and clear enough to think in her mind that I've got to put this together and I can help them and I can help solve this crime. But I don't think that 1514 was meant to victimize her and make
no,
her have
but
to
do in other words, if I take a look at the appendix and I look at Detective Vaughn's statement that he took from Ms. Bolden, I will find that she did not act at the instigation of law enforcement officials when she supplied his name and his social security number.
I believe that's the appendix and also the transcript from the suppression hearing, which is part of the record in this case as well. Now, I will tell you that there is the word search made of records in Detective Vaughn's report, but search is by no means meant to mean an actual conducting of a search pursuant to a Fourth Amendment type analysis. It just meant she went to look for records to find something to substantiate what she recalled.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. William.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Williams, and I represent Susan Bolden. The district court did not err in granting Ms. Bolden's 12B6 motion to dismiss for two reasons. First of all, Mr. Lewis pled all of the essential elements of the defense under the Right to Financial Privacy Act, and secondly, the Right to Financial Privacy Act's immunity provision is broad enough to include all of the claims that Mr. Bolden has brought here or could bring that would be consistent with the facts that he's alleged.
Mr. Williams, are you taking no position on whether the 1514 order has any continuing importance to this case?
Well, Your Honor, my first instinct is not to jump into that fray, but I think that based upon what I've heard here today, I'd like to address the issue of mootness because, quite frankly, I don't believe that it is moot. I think that that order still has effect. In fact, Mr. Lewis has filed a lawsuit in state court in Fort Wayne, and we have asserted that protective order in defense of that lawsuit. So it is not moot. Mr. Lewis is continuing to file lawsuits. He's continuing to try to harass Ms. Bolden and harass the credit union.
How long is he in prison?
I'm not exactly sure. Ms. Nome would know that.
The protective order is for 3 years, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. But back to my two points, Mr. Lewis pled all of the essential elements of the immunity defense under the Right to Financial Privacy Act. He pled, first of all, there must be an employee of a financial institution. That's one of the elements of the immunity defense. And Mr. Lewis pled in paragraph 3 that Ms. Bolden was the branch manager of the credit union. Therefore, that element's met. The next element is that the disclosure must be to a government authority relevant to a possible violation of the statute of regulation. Mr. Lewis alleged in paragraph 5 of his complaint that the credit union was robbed. In paragraph 7 and 9, he alleges that Ms. Bolden provided his name and social security number to law enforcement officers after she heard the radio dispatch in which the dispatcher referenced a vehicle carrying two black males, which matched a description of a vehicle that she was aware credit union employees had seen and was acting suspicious prior to the robbery. So she made the connection based upon that dispatch. Therefore, this element has been met. And then the final element of the defense is that the disclosure can only be of the name or other identifying information. And here in paragraph 9, Mr. Lewis has alleged that the disclosure was of his name and social security number only. I see that my time is up. Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. Do you have something to add?
Just a few points in response to the arguments made by counsel. First, the relevant question would be not whether the record indicates whether Ms. Bolden made her disclosure in response or jointly as part of the investigation or whether she was acting independently. The relevant question is whether the complaint unmistakably shows that that is in fact the case. And the complaint does not bear the weight that the government or Ms. Bolden would have it bear. But the second point would be that in the specific page reference would be SA-74 for the supplemental appendix as to Detective Vaughn's report. And Detective Vaughn's report does not indicate one way or the other whether Ms. Bolden was acting independently or whether she was acting jointly with members of the Federal Bank Robbery Task Force. And the fact that she was being questioned at the time that she made her disclosures certainly makes the inference that she was acting jointly with law enforcement as opposed to acting independently. That's just as reasonable an inference as that she was acting independently. So for that reason, even if you were to go outside the complaint, which district court should not have done at the motion to dismiss stage, the record doesn't shed light on this question either. The other point I would make is that the government has a theory as to how Ms. Bolden came to suspect that Mr. Lewis was somehow connected with this robbery, and that theory may in fact bear out. Ms. Bolden will have an opportunity to make her make a defense under Section 3403C, but the question for this court at this point is whether the complaint necessarily admits all the essential ingredients of an affirmative defense under Section 3403C, and the answer to that question is no. Thank you.
Were you appointed for this? Or
I was, Judge Mannion.
You were? Well, we appreciate that and your fine representation for your client.
Thank you.
Thank you. That completes the arguments for the day. This case will be taken under advisement. In case the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.